and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Our topic today is Make Art, Not Trash, and I am delighted to be speaking with Elizabeth Roberts, an incredible artist out here on the Oregon coast. Elizabeth Roberts is an avid beachcomber and a beach artist from Brandon, Oregon. She's a passionate outdoor enthusiast and a contributing artist at the Wash to Shore project in Brandon. I was blown away when I first saw her works, and I continue to be amazed. Welcome, Elizabeth. Could you tell us more about yourself?
Yeah, well, I grew up here in the Pacific Northwest. I went to high school in Curry County and spent a lot of time exploring the beaches, rivers, and forests. I think that's probably where my love of beachcombing began. In my early 20s, I had the opportunity to travel to Kodiak Island in Alaska for 2 months. I fell in love with Alaska and ended up packing up everything I owned in the back of a pickup truck and moved to Kodiak, and I spent about 18 years there before moving back down to the Oregon coast in 2014.
18 years. So when did you go up there?
I went up there in 95 and moved up there in 96.
Holy cow, 18 years. What did you do while you were up there? Like, did you have a job while you were up there, or did you?
Yeah, I mean, I did a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I raised a family. I was we were a fishing family, and I did a lot of artists in schools work. I mean, there's a lot of that stuff that actually plays a big role in how I got to do what I'm doing now. So
let's go back to the beginning. What's your background that led you to this work?
I've always had a creative mindset, and I've made art in some form or another throughout my life. I've explored a lot of different mediums over the years. Mixed media and fiber art seem to be, you know, where my creativity often lead me. Working with fiber art, I find translates really well into working with marine debris. Because I'm always, you know, trying to create textures in my work. I was doing a lot of artists in schools work in the Kodiak Island Borough School District when I lived there. And later I went on to open a fiber art shop in 2004. And it was pretty cool because I helped support like a thriving art community, which is great. We held a lot of community art shows, you know, themed art shows there. Eventually, you know, sold the business and it was sold to a good friend who was an avid knitter and fiber artist. Yeah. So the business is still going all these years later because I opened it in 2004, and here it is, you know, 2024.
Right. 20 years.
And it's still a treasured part of the community, which I love knowing that. So
just help me out a sec. What, for laymen, what is fiber art when you use that word?
So that's like working with natural fibers like wool, cotton, hemp, you know, it encompasses knitting, crochet, spinning yarn, felting, you know, things like that.
So looking back, what was your greatest inspiration that led you to this kind of work?
Probably my dad. He was always making or building things, you know, when I was growing up. I was pretty much grew up playing in his sawdust piles. You know, he welded, he soldered things. Like when he, back in the day, wanted to upgrade his computer, he got the soldering iron out and the circuits and like did his own circuit board. So there wasn't anything really that he couldn't create or build. So I feel like he was probably a big inspiration for me growing up.
Yeah. And it sounds like you weren't afraid of any of those kind of materials, like afraid of machines or afraid of exploring and breaking something. I know that stops a lot of people. They're just afraid of just messing up. So they're afraid to, you know, try these things.
I still have some of those fears. So you just push through them.
So what's your training, and is training even needed, I would assume, for an artist?
I'd say curiosity and a willingness to try things. I don't think there's really any special training needed. Just some basic experience with power tools as far as working with marine debris. Though you can certainly do marine debris art without power tools. It's a little more limiting you can accomplish with the materials. So like, I use bandsaws, jigsaws, you know, drill press. Right. Power tools.
So what came first, your interest? Well, I think you told me your interest in the environment sounds like it came first, or maybe not.
Well, to me, they're one and the same. As a kid, you know, when you look up the sky, you see shapes in the clouds, you know, abstract reflections in the water, color changes in the sky as the sun sets or as the leaves turn color in the fall. To me, they're one and the same. I couldn't choose one another because I feel that they're connected.
Right. And I'm a rabid environmentalist, and I love nature, and I love the patterns and whatnot out in nature. And I love art, but I'm not good at it. Or maybe somebody told me I wasn't good at it, that I couldn't draw when I was little. I think that's how we all start. Can you draw? And nobody can draw. I mean, some folks can, but, and so a lot of people, I feel like, are raised that, like, if you can't draw a Mickey Mouse, you're not an artist. And so I have a lot of art in my house, but none of my own stuff. As much as I've messed around with art, I don't have the guts kind of to put it up in my own house. So I think that's, you know, this is really.
We're all our own worst critics when it comes to making art. I criticize myself constantly.
Right. I think my favorite lately is poor art, poor paint, because it seems to me you can't screw it up and it all looks awesome. But anything else, I think I'd be afraid to put it up in my house. I was going to ask what drew you to the ocean, but it sounds like you were born on the coast here.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on the coast. I didn't spend a lot of time at the ocean as a kid. You know, it was kind of in the background or in the peripheral growing up. But having lived on an island for 18 years in a fishing community, you develop a deep relationship with the sea. Your entire world is pretty much ruled by tides and weather. You know, the sea, it sustains you. And but it's, you know, it's also to be respected because, you know, it can take as much as it gives. I would say my 18 years in Alaska living on an island really solidified my relationship with the ocean.
That's fantastic. Again, I asked a little bit before, do you have training as an artist? Like, did you go to college or did you take courses or you just
explored? I've always made art since I was old enough to hold a crayon.
So that's cool. That means anyone can.
Anyone can.
Your focus now, it seems to be, is on plastics.
Yeah.
So how do you find the plastics and how do you prepare it for use in art?
You know, I go out and I spend a lot of time beach combing, and so I'll find materials that I feel are suitable for working with. You know, I bring them home, I'll rinse them off, you know, try to rinse off all the sand, and then I have a process of washing and cleaning the materials, and then everything gets sorted either by size or by color or by object. It depends. And I just have all these materials available to me in my studio.
Why the focus on plastics?
Well, I got started turning plastic into beach, you know, and marine debris art in 2013. So this, it all kind of stems back to a point in my life where I decided I was going to do work that either I learned a new skill, I gave back in some way, or it simply fed my soul. And I did, you know, a few different odd jobs, seasonal work, but an opportunity presented itself to volunteer on a large scale marine debris removal project in the Gulf of Alaska. It was on Tigetik Island, which is at the south end of the Kodiak Archipelago. It's an uninhabited island. It's critical habitat for harbor seals and ground nesting birds because it's one of the few islands that doesn't have any predators. So I spent 5 weeks living in a tent and doing what I call extreme beach combing, where you have to pick up everything you find. And it quickly became a daily meditation on what away meant. So like when you throw something away, where does it actually go? Because I was finding things that I personally used or purchased or had at home, or even like things that I had encountered in childhood, like even toys that I had played with as a kid. So it really got me questioning, you know, were any of these things mine at one point, you know? So it was eye-opening. And the amount of debris on this 11-mile stretch of beach on an uninhabited island was overwhelming. We probably removed at least 80,000 pounds of marine debris from that. Some of it's from the 2011 tsunami. Some of it's, you know, commercial fishing gear. And then you also have container ship spills, which are quite common in the Pacific Ocean. I think, if I remember correctly, it's something like at least minimum 14 containers. Maybe that's a low ball number year that get washed off of those big barges that ship the containers over from Asia. So we're, you know, constantly, you know, seeing things wash up, you know, on our shores from some of those spills.
That's crazy, because you would imagine up in Alaska, there'd be nothing but seashells and whatnot. And
unfortunately, that's not the case.
That's sad. That's really sad.
Yeah, it was an eye-opening experience. And then after those 5 weeks of kind of that being my reality for, you know, day-to-day, going back into, you know, civilization, it's like I couldn't unsee it. Suddenly it's everywhere. Whereas I didn't see it before, I could not see it. It was everywhere. Like I went to the grocery store and was just like horrified for the first time in my life that everything on those shelves was packaged in plastic, and just how hard it was, especially living up there, because everything's, you know, barged or shipped in, to find stuff that's not packaged in plastic. Right. It became very challenging and very limiting on what I would purchase at that point. because I just felt like I could not continue to live my life in the way that I was living it and contributing to the problem. Because it wasn't something people were talking about back in 2013. It wasn't, you know, a buzzword like it is now. I'm happy that more people are aware. But in the 10 years that I've been, you know, involved in this, I've seen some changes, but not on the scale that we need.
You know, it's interesting. I remember reading an interview long ago about the inventor of plastic, but I remember him making a point that he was relieved to have come out with a product that would now save trees, because we wouldn't be cutting down the trees to package things in paper containers or cardboard or whatnot, that plastic would save all the trees.
Yeah, I think he would have done that. But, you know, we had quite a few people in our country's history that just did not want to see hemp surpass, you know, trees
right,
for the paper.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. You solve one problem and you just grab up another one. So you said to prepare this plastic debris, you wash it. Do you ever put it in, let's say, like a rock polisher or something? Is that a technique?
No.
Or I was just curious.
No, I haven't done that. I think that would just create more microplastics. I mean, I do when I cut it with saws, it does create, you know, smaller pieces, but I try to vacuum those up. And I'm doing that indoors and not outdoors.
And I assume you then keep all those smaller pieces even for a later potential project?
Yeah, I try to hang on to stuff that I know I can use later, but there is stuff that does end up in the trash.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your process. Do you envision like a finished sculpture first? Or like I do, when I do art, when I build with Legos, for instance, I just start and see where it goes. How about you? Do you?
For the most part, I mean, in some projects, you know, in some art forms, I just do exploratory, you know, art where I just play with the materials and get to know them. But I've found with the marine debris, I usually have an idea in mind of what I want to create, or I find something when I'm out beachcombing that inspires me to want to create something. So I usually have an idea in mind before I start.
And did you try to stick strictly with plastics, or do you ever bring in wood or driftwood or metals or?
I mostly work with the plastics. I do use things like screws and wire, you know, to assemble things. I try to minimize adhesives, though. If I'm working on a smaller scale, sometimes using an adhesive is necessary. And I try to minimize paint. I do use a little bit here and there if I'm to maybe shade a little something. Or if, you know, like I created a penguin and had to have a color gradient on the beak, just trying to make it more, you know, anatomically correct and more
right.
Scientifically accurate. So I might use a little paint, you know, to highlight something, but I try to limit it because, you know, again, you're just creating more waste.
Right.
Using, you know, adhesives and spray paint and stuff like that. But I do use some of it in some of my marine debris work. I use it more in a series that I create called Trash Fish.
Uh-huh.
They're a series of fish that I've been making now for a long time. And they're kind of a hybridized between marine debris and upcycled materials. I use a lot of bottle caps and shotgun shells and things like that. But I also include, you know, net and rope and flip-flops and, you know, stuff like that. And I do find a lot of shotgun shells on the beach, actually. So,
yeah, I imagine. Yeah.
And those are built kind of on a wood base. So a lot of my wall art does have a wood base that I build off of, but my sculptural pieces, the three-dimensional sculptural pieces, are genuinely just all plastics from the inside out.
From the inside out. I was going to ask you if there was a frame or whatnot that you
No,
work around.
I start building with just plastic, like good sturdy pieces of plastic. But I know when I worked with Washed Ashore, we did do metal framework because the sculptures are so large that we built over a metal framework.
Okay, that I asked you why you focus on plastic trash. And that,
yeah, I just feel it's important to get the message out there, you know, to spark conversations about the impact our consumer choices are having on the environment. And
right.
I mean, the best way for me to do that is through art, because, you know, you don't need to, you can view art and it transcends all language barriers.
Right.
You know, it's one of the few tools that we have to convey really important messages in our society. You know, I think art has been the most powerful tool towards social changes.
Well, like you say, it also speaks across all languages.
Yeah.
And all ages, I would expect.
Yeah.
From the young to the very old. Yeah. How do you work with debris safely? Like
So like when you're out beachcombing, you know, you kind of want to wear gloves. I know plastics, when they're in an aquatic environment, they are sort of a magnet for inorganic pollutants, things like pesticides, herbicides, petroleum products, even like pharmaceuticals that people tend to flush down the toilet, which I don't recommend. Those things end up in our waterways. They're not always filtered out by wastewater treatment, and they'll accumulate on plastic. Fish eat that. Those toxins bioaccumulate in their tissue, and it just travels up the food chain, and it's in our food. And that's why I started that whole series of trash fish, because I use metal forks as sort of a, for the fins, as kind of a nod towards that, these toxic chemicals are ending up on our dinner plates. Plastic is in our food. It's in the water. It's pervasive. There was just a study done in Japan that they found plastic particles in the rain above Kilimanjaro. It's in the air we breathe. They have found it in the human heart for the first time this year. It's been found in human placenta. So it's in our lungs. It's in our body. We consume it. Anytime you drink something out of a plastic bottle, you're consuming tiny microfibers of plastic from the production of that bottle. It used to be that we consumed about a credit card's worth of plastic every year, but it's increased since then.
I had never thought about that.
But yeah, so wearing gloves when you're out there cleaning it up on the beach is important. I wear gloves, rubber gloves, when I'm cleaning it. After at that point, once I've cleaned it, I use anything from hot soapy water to the smaller things that are harder to scrub, like bottle cap size, little tiny things. I'll soak those for several days in a solution of vinegar and water just to kill any kind of, anything that might be living on it. But everything gets washed in hot soapy water and, rinsed, and it gets lays out in the sun for a little bit to kind of dry, and then gets put away.
So real natural ways of cleaning as opposed to bleach or something more
Yeah, I don't
harsh.
recommend bleach, but vinegar is a really safe way to kind of sterilize things. But the hot soapy water helps too. I scrub things.
Vinegar and then the sun.
Yeah,
Is there a trick to the trade? Like I would imagine if I was going out looking for shark teeth or whatnot, you go out after a storm. Do you kind of follow that?
Storms tend to churn up a lot of stuff. Especially stuff that's buried, that gets buried in the sands, because here on the Oregon coast in the summertime we get a lot of wind. So it's shifting the sand around a lot. So if there's stuff that's been washed up in the wintertime that doesn't get picked up, it gets buried. And so when we have these big king tide events or these big storms, often, there's a lot of erosion that happens in the foredunes, and it'll expose a lot of stuff. And then stuff gets buried too under like the driftwood. So when those things lift up in the king tides and they float, they release a lot of things that might be trapped underneath. So yeah, definitely after the king tides, wintertime, that seems to be when we find the most stuff on the beach, either washing up or being exposed. So I try to go out in the wintertime. The summertime is really not the best time for, doing a lot of marine debris removal, just because a lot of that stuff does get buried by the sand, so you don't tend to find as much in the summertime. And I know a lot of people like to do beach cleanups in the summertime, because it's when there's a lot of people around and people are out and about, and we have a lot of tourists and stuff.
And it's
But
warm.
yeah, and it's warm, but really the biggest impact would be to go out after the king tides and then in the wintertime, because that's when the stuff's coming in, especially when you get a westerly storm that's blowing stuff in.
Then what kind of beach would you look for? Would you look for a sandy beach, a rocky beach, a cliffy beach? Does it matter?
It does not
It's
matter,
all.
but I do find that stuff accumulates more towards the mouths of the rivers,
Mouth of the
because
rivers,
I think some of that too is because stuff during those storms and high water events is washing things down as well. About 80% of the stuff that ends up in the ocean does come from land, and it does come from upstream.
All right,
But
that makes sense.
yeah.
Well, have you been all over the world doing this kind of activity? Looking for debris, plastics.
A little bit. I did spend some time in Norway in 2017. I was on an expedition in the Gulf of Maine in 2015 with the Roselia Project and Parley for the Oceans. We were doing data collection. So it was a very different experience for me, coming off these large scale cleanups in Alaska, where we, scoured the beach and picked up everything we could find. This was more scientific. So we had a data set and we only collected what was in the data set, which really hard for me not to be able to pick up everything we found. But yeah, so that was an interesting experience. I spent a couple weeks on a sailboat going down and visiting the different islands out in the Gulf of Maine and doing these data sets. And then we would plug that information into a PowerPoint presentation, because we would sort everything that we collected and categorize it and, you know, log it, which we didn't do, you know, when I was doing cleanups in Alaska. But we would put all that data into a PowerPoint presentation and present to the communities that we were in, so that the information that we were giving them about what we were finding was relevant to their community.
So that project too was collecting debris and trash.
But it was more for data than what I'd been doing in Alaska. And then, yeah, I spent some time, like I said, spent some time in Norway, working with an artist collective called Bemlo Kunstlag out of Bemlo, Norway. And they reached out to me. I have a good friend who lives there and who's part of this artist collective. And she had reached out to me because she knew at the time I'd been doing work with Washed Ashore. And they had a rare Cuvier beaked whale that had swam into one of the harbors in Norway. It was sick, and they were trying to get it to swim back out, but it kept coming in, and they had to euthanize it because it was in really bad shape. And when they did the necropsy, they discovered that the whale's stomach was full of plastic, and it sparked a conversation nationally about plastic pollution. And so she reached out, wanting me to come and work with their artist collective to build a sculpture. And so they did a whole series of beach cleanups, like nationwide. They got on it. And and so I spent a month over there working with Bemlo Kunstlag, and then also a nonprofit called Seasick Fish. And so I did some community workshops, and we built this really cool sculpture that's still kind of traveling around the country of Norway and educating people about plastic pollution.
Wow, that's really cool. This project you're telling me, when you're going down the islands and you said you could only collect certain things that were in your data sets, what was the point of that? Like, what were they collecting, and why would they avoid? Why were they specific in what they were wanting to grab?
Well, we would collect everything within that 100 meter data set. It was just NOAA marine debris surveys are the same way. You have, when you go do those surveys, you have like 100 meters. I think it's 100 meters. Just a data set, and you collect everything within that data set.
So you mean that space area?
Yes.
So, and I get it. So anything within that space area, not necessarily particular types of objects.
Yeah, no, we would collect everything within that space.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a way to get more, I guess, accuracy.
Right.
You're looking for data for scientific research.
Right. Yeah. It's scientists, when they do explorations in the field, they draw the circle.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's the same concept.
That makes sense. Do you find any difference in the waste you find on the East Coast, West Coast,
Norway
Coast?
Yeah, definitely. And that was, for me, what I was most curious about, and why I was really interested in going to the East Coast, is just to see what kind of things were washing up there. There's some similarities, you know, both coasts. We obviously get, you know, commercial fishing year relative to the fisheries that we have. But here on the West Coast, I think we get a lot more diverse items because we do have the trade routes from Asia and the shipping containers and the tsunami. So I think we find a lot more stuff here than we do on the East Coast. The East Coast seem to be more fishing gear, and then just basic, packaging, you know, that people might discard or, you know. Here on the West Coast, we find more like household objects and commercial, you know, other commercial industry things.
Right.
So they do get some fun things, I think, on the East Coast that we don't get here, like Lego. They had a Lego spill, container spill. But yeah, I don't find as much of the types of things that I find here over on the East Coast. So there's a little bit of a difference.
Have you noticed the type of trash you're seeing left by people enjoying the beach? Do you feel like they take care of a little bit better their beaches out west than they do out east? And that's, of course, a huge generalization.
You know, I didn't spend a whole lot of time on, public beaches when I
Okay.
was out there. It was mostly going to these little island communities and kind of hitting these remote spots.
Right.
And we'd find things like styrofoam from docks and,
Right.
lobster fishing traps and bands and tags and buoys and plastic bottles, mostly drink
Right.
bottles. Lots of wrappers, from food products and things like that.
And now styrofoam
And rope.
counts for you, right? Styrofoam's
Yeah.
an
Oh, yeah.
unabraded
That's,
user.
to me, one of the worst offenders
Yeah.
in the marine environment.
And I bet you'd find a lot of it.
Yeah. Oh,
Yeah, that'd be a
absolutely.
big one. Are you seeing any more or less in the amount of debris you've been finding in the last, I don't know, 15 years?
Yes and no. It just honestly, it depends on the weather. It depends on the tides and what direction, the wind is blowing as to what, years stuff washes up. Sometimes we have years where a lot of things get kicked out of that gyre, and makes it to shore. Other years, the winds and tides aren't right, so we don't see it. But
Oh, interesting.
there's no shortage of plastic going into the ocean, unfortunately. So I don't really see it going away anytime soon,
Right,
sadly.
right. So when you talk about in general marine debris, how are you speaking specifically about that? Is that anything and everything, or to you, does that mean the plastics or
So marine debris is pretty much anything man-made
man-made?
that
Okay.
isn't, meant to be in the ocean.
Right.
So, I mean, even I know even like orange peels and banana peels can be considered marine debris, even though a lot of us are like, oh, well, that's biodegradable. Sometimes it takes a really long time for it to biodegrade, but that is still like listed as marine debris. I think of it more in terms of, for me, it's like, plastics and styrofoams and those
Okay.
types of materials that don't biodegrade, that are unnatural. So if it doesn't biodegrade to me, that, I classify that more as marine debris than say, lumber or, dimensional lumber or, fruit peelings,
Right, 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 right. Okay. Then what's a microplastic?
So microplastic is the result of photo degradation of, breaking down of plastic into smaller and smaller particles because it doesn't biodegrade, it just photodegrades. So it becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. Like every time you wash your clothes, if you are washing synthetic clothes, those clothes are shedding microplastics that you can't really see with your eye, but you can see them under a microscope, those little fibers. And yeah, every time you do laundry, you're just shedding like
Right.
thousands of pieces of microplastic into our ocean because the wastewater treatment plant does not filter those out. The problem with microplastics is that it now is available to interact with things like plankton, which it has been found in plankton as being consumed by plankton, which is a little frightening because that is the foundation of the marine food web. Pretty much everything eats plankton in the ocean in some form or another. And so, yeah,
Exactly.
fish eat it. It's in our shellfish. They've found it in oysters. They find it's in crab. It's very pervasive on that level, and we don't really understand what the impacts are going to be because the chemicals in plastics, they're endocrine disruptors. So
How do you
they,
mean?
an endocrine disruptor, basically, it mimics like estrogen in the body. So, yeah, and we're discovering that the impacts on, living things, consuming these toxic chemicals in the that are in these plastics, how they disrupt, our biological functions, as
Right.
living beings. So there's a lot of research going into that. So I'm not a scientist, so I'm not gonna go too much into that.
Right.
But the research is out there if you want to dig a little deeper on how plastic mimics estrogen in the body. Learn more about what an endocrine disruptor
Oh,
is.
right. we hear a lot about carbon footprints. Can you tell me about a plastic footprint?
Oh yeah, we all have a plastic footprint. You can't help but notice your plastic footprints once you start looking around your house and in your grocery cart when you go to the store. So I've tried to reduce my plastic footprint. I know it's not easy to do. And especially, you know, for families with, you know, lots of kids, it's a lot harder. For me, I started buying things in bulk. I started cooking more from scratch and buying less prepackaged foods. Right. The biggest one for me that I think anybody can do, especially here in Oregon, we're really blessed to have a lot of farmers market and local growers, is buy your produce from someone local. You're lowering both your plastic footprint and your carbon footprint because that stuff's not being trucked in from somewhere else.
Right.
So yeah, I do a lot of, you know, buy locally, buy in bulk. I do a lot of canning and preserving. I try to have a kitchen garden, at least supplement, you know, what I cook with some of the things that I can grow. I try to bring reusables with me, reusable bags, you know, reusable cups. I'm still trying to condition myself to bring, you know, to have containers for like if I go out to eat, and I don't eat all my food and I want to bring some of those leftovers home with me, to try to have a container with me so that I'm not bringing home a styrofoam or plastic or, you know, they have that biodegradable, and I say that with quotations, biodegradable plastic, but unfortunately that stuff only biodegrades under the right conditions. It has to be a perfect condition. The temperature of the soil right. has to be just right for that stuff to break down. So it won't biodegrade in your own compost pile. It'll be there forever.
Right. That's a really good idea. I hadn't thought about taking my own container.
Yeah. And I think Oregon was looking into legislation to where you could do that, where you could go to, you know, a store or a restaurant and bring your own containers to have them filled. And I know a lot of food co-ops, you can refill shampoos, refill it, like grind your own nut butters and get, you know, refill soaps and vinegars and oils, which is nice. I'd like to see that take off more. And I'd see more and more bulk food options happening in places like, you know, big box stores like Fred Meyer's. They revamped right. their whole health food section to incorporate a lot more bulk food options, which is really nice to see.
Right. And you may already have answered this in a ways, but is plastic waste harder to redirect or store or yeah. remove than other types of stuff out there?
So, yeah, you know, I know we talk about recycling plastic, but the amount of plastic that actually gets recycled is so minuscule. We kind of live in this myth that, oh, when you put it in the recycle bin, it's totally going to get recycled. And that's not really the case, especially with things like plastic bottles. They don't really get recycled so much as they get downcycled. Plastic bottles usually get turned into things like carpeting, things like carpets, which will eventually end up in the landfill anyways. There really is not, you know, infrastructure in place to deal with ocean plastics. There are several organizations and companies that are repurposing ocean plastics into packaging and products to kind of draw awareness to the issue and try to, you know, find solutions, but it's really not enough. Right. A lot of this stuff, you know, some people will use it waste to energy, which they burn it for electricity, which to me is not the best solution because that, you know, creates a lot of toxicity when it's being burned.
And then puts it up in the air where we breathe it.
Kind of. I don't know how well they can scrub that, you know, before it's released, but maybe the technology is better. I don't know. But a lot of it just ends up in the landfill. So a lot of the stuff that I helped clean up during the time I was working on large-scale cleanup operations in Alaska, the intention was, it was all barged down to Seattle. And the intention was that it was going to be sorted, and what could be recycled was going to be recycled. But unfortunately, the city of Seattle deemed it a hazardous waste and would not allow it to be sorted. And it all ended up in a landfill in northeastern Oregon, unfortunately.
Wow.
And it was, they actually had to weld two barges together to carry down all of the debris that was collected in Alaska. And they did pick up some stuff on the way, I think from BC. Because there was a big concentrated effort funds from the Japanese government to do marine debris cleanup. They donated $1 million to the state of Alaska to mediate all of the stuff that was, which is amazing to me that they went through such a traumatic natural disaster, that they would give, you know, us $1 million to clean up whatever washed up from, you know, that disaster. Like, that was extremely generous and like just mind blowing to me because, you know, they suffered like terrible damage from that tsunami.
Right.
You know?
Wow. Well, on the other hand, is plastic easier to use than, like you mentioned, carpet? Is that considered plastic?
Yeah.
I guess. Okay. So is plastic easy? Because you were saying bottles were downgraded to carpet and whatnot. Is plastic easier to use as an artist? Is it more stable or easier to clean or?
Oh, I mean, it's definitely easy to clean. But it's not, I wouldn't call it stable because it does break down over time. It does become more and more brittle, especially when it's exposed to sunlight, to UV radiation.
Right.
It breaks down. It becomes brittle. I find, you know, like red plastics are some of the first to break down because for whatever reason, there's science behind it on the color spectrum. Huh. But that red plastic breaks down pretty quick. So does white. It actually bleaches out to white and then is just completely brittle.
Oh, interesting.
The ones that seem to fade the least are black plastics and blue and green. But I find that any colors, you know, that are starting to lean towards red tend to photodegrade faster.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so it does get brittle. You know, I do find that sometimes I have to replace pieces on some of the work that I do, which, you know, if I, you know, have created something for, like, I just finished a piece for the Alaka Alliance.
The sea otter?
Yeah, it's a sea otter.
Love it.
I just finished it, and it's now kind of on display right now at the Manly Art Center in Brookings. I have a solo show there through the month of October, so there's a little bit of time left to go see it. But yeah, they'll be using that piece when they table events for education and whatnot. But I tell them, you know, if anything gets brittle or breaks or whatever, just bring it back and I'll repair it, you know.
I've been preparing for this interview this week, and every time I tell somebody who I'm talking to this weekend, I've shown that picture of that sea otter. he's just fantastic. Well, I don't know if he's a he or girl or boy, but fantastic. That was gorgeous. That was really cool, which makes you think again, that was all plastic or were there metal pieces or whatnot? Were there screws or nuts or something? That
I use screws and I use some wire, but it's all made from marine debris. I just use the screws and the wire and just a little bit of two-part epoxy to secure a few things here and there.
Have never known that was trash, your debris.
Yeah, that's all marine debris.
That was fantastic. And then I saw on the wall behind it, the fish.
Those are those trash fish I was talking about. Yeah.
It's the coolest demo. I loved it. That was neat. Now, you can't tell me that he was all gray pieces, or did you have to use some paint to make them all?
No,
or maybe you use, can.
No, I actually, he was all brown. Like that's all brown plastic, which is actually not an easy color to find. I don't find a lot of brown.
I was gonna say.
So I was really struggling to make that work with what I had.
I am impressed.
And then that silver color that is on his face, that was just a large piece of plastic that I had to cut up and break down into those smaller pieces to kind of create that fuzzy texture for his head. I did have to paint a few pieces to match that because that's not a common color.
No, nobody's going to paint something gray and as a toy for a child or brown.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do find like darker gray things, but this is such kind of a light silvery gray. It's not a common color.
Yeah.
So I did have to paint a few things to create texture on the back of the head of that sea otter.
That's really incredible because I just assumed you had some structure under it, some kind of frame. And I mean, this is how I would approach it. Some frame
underneath. if you actually go to my Instagram page, which is Marine Debris 911.
Okay.
You can, at the top of my page, you'll find a little circle of all, you know, circles of all the different sculptures I've built. And it shows you the process I use. you can
Oh, I'll do that.
You can see from the beginning to kind of the end on the sea otter, the process and how I built it.
Oh, that's cool. I'm like so motivated to go out to the ocean tomorrow. Like I'm absolutely. So what's the most unique thing that you've ever found? Unique trash. I bet you get this question all the time.
I do. And I have pretty much found everything you can imagine. But I think the coolest thing I've ever found were these little orange plastic NOAA drift cards. So they're these little orange cards. I found two that were intact and then a fragment of another one. And each one has an identification number. And luckily that fragment had the number on it. And I knew what it was when I found it. They just said, if found, return to this address and we'll send you $1. And I'm like, cool. Well, I don't care about the money. I'm just curious what these are.
Right.
So I send them in. And later I received an email that said, hey, from NOAA, hey, we're not really sure what these are. We'll get back to you. And I was like, what do you mean you don't know what these are? It says NOAA. It's got your logo on it and everything. Right. And apparently they had, I don't know if you've ever heard, if you know who Dr. Curtis Ebbesmeyer is, but he's a famous, well-known and respected oceanographer who studies ocean currents. And he had to go digging through their archives to figure out what these were. And so back in the 70s, these cards were dropped in the ocean to study ocean currents, see where they ended up. And so one of the cards was dropped in Puget Sound. And the other one in Juan de Fuca. I don't know if I said that correctly. But those two cards were dropped about the same time. And I found these cards, mind you, and that fragment, all within the same, 100-meter stretch of beach on Tagetik Island.
Uh-huh.
So that fragment, and this is the cool part, was actually dropped off the coast of Nantucket. And, and actually traveled over through the ice pack and came out in the Bering Sea and into the Gulf of Alaska. And so he reckons the reason it was just a fragment is because the ice pack broke it up,
ate some of it
into pieces. And so that was just huge to find that in the Gulf of Alaska when it had been dropped in Nantucket.
Right.
So I feel pretty good about being able
pretty useful there.
Contribute to scientific research.
That's really cool. That's neat.
Yeah. And, you find notes in bottles and things like that.
Yeah. Have you found any of those to return? Notes in the bottles or just
I did reach out and didn't get a response. I think I've found stuff from merchant vessels. I did find a drift bottle from a Canadian research project, and I did get in touch with them and let them know where I found it and all that stuff. So and sometimes I can't read the writing, the notes because they're written in a different language. So, but that's always kind of exciting when you find one.
It would seem to me bottles would be easy to use. And maybe this is a silly thing to say, but is bottles a safer type of debris for us to leave in our oceans than plastics? Are they less damaging? Yeah, glass bottles.
Well, I don't recommend throwing anything out in the ocean. I mean, glass is inert. It's not toxic. It's not really harmful. It just kind of breaks down and becomes sand again eventually.
Right.
We got plenty of filter feeders that, whales that are filter feeding. I don't know if I'd really want to toss glass bottles in there. I mean, glass is definitely a better alternative to plastic. But
should be going in.
But the whole reason plastic was so popular is because you could drop it and it wouldn't break.
Right. And it would float.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any legal issues you should be aware of? Trespassing or stealing or I don't know. When you're out there collecting, I'm talking about a family maybe with their kids going out this weekend.
Well, I mean, Oregon, all of our entire coastline's public. So, if you just stay on, on the wet sand area, just in the foredance, our beaches are public. So I don't think you have to really worry about that. If you stick to the beach and
just don't go up too much higher on the dunes that might belong to people or whatnot.
Yeah. Most things you're going to find are going to be just right there, in the foredune area. Yeah,
just common courtesy.
I mean, some stuff does get washed up higher, but for the most part, our beaches are public.
Right.
So I don't think you have to worry so much about that.
What about if this family goes out, this hypothetical family called myself tomorrow to collect with my son and my husband. And I'm just not feeling it. We collected a lot of stuff. I get home. I'm not feeling it. I'm not feeling the inspiration is not coming to me. What do I do with all this stuff then? Is there a way I could, I don't know about get it to you, but get it to someone or get it to a group
that
might be able to use it?
Wash Ashore would love to take your trash. They have a couple drop-off points. They have one here in Bandon over by the Farm and Sea building down on the waterfront where we have the farmer's market.
Uh-huh.
And then they also have another drop-off point up in, I believe, North Bend, Coos Bay, North Bend area.
Okay.
So those are two places that people can drop stuff off. Yeah.
Good, good. Now, when you say drop off your trash, you mean like solid stuff. Like they wouldn't want a bunch of, I don't know, trash. Like, or would they?
If you go and do a beach cleanup, they'll take it. You just leave the bag with them. They'll take it. They'll sort through it, what they can use and what ends up in the trash.
Okay. So they'll sort out like the newspaper mm-hmm. or baggies or whatever.
They'll sort it out.
That's cool. Tell me this. This is something I've always wanted because I write a little bit better than I art. But you know, when you've been assigned a topic or you just feel like writing or whatever, and you have writer's block, is there such thing as a artist block?
For me, there is definitely. I definitely hit periods where I just don't feel creative and I struggle, you know, with finding the energy to put into a project. I kind of think it's normal.
Yeah.
You know, to have periods of time where you're just not feeling it.
Right.
You know, if I go too long, I will kind of push myself out of that funk that I'm in and maybe I'll just prep materials and maybe not, you know, do something that isn't going to require a lot of creative input.
Right.
Just sometimes going through the motions of making something will kind of rekindle that creative spark for me. So a lot of times I might just be prepping materials, you know, for making my trash fish, because I've done it so many times, I don't really have to put that creative mind, you know, set right. into it. So I can just kind of go through the motions of making it and then getting back into that kind of, you know, that muscle memory of creating will often, you know, get me back into feeling creative and wanting to make other things. So,
right. For a while, I taught art. Yes, I taught art to children. And you'd start with the basic stuff and they would be so offended if one did a really cool something, something, I don't know. And the other ones copied them. They were very offended that you're cheating. That's copying. Now, after talking to you and planning my trip tomorrow, I fully intend to try to copy your sea otter. Do you take offense to that?
No, I don't. Cause I mean, there's that old adage that, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Right.
And as artists, we borrow from what we see, you know, our artists are inspired by other artists, you know, like, you know, your sea otter that you make is not going to look necessarily like my sea otter. So
I can guarantee that.
And when it comes to plastic pollution, I'm like, copy away. The more people doing this, the better. As far as I'm concerned, the beaches will, you know, be a better place for it, and so will our environment and more awareness.
Right.
So, yeah.
No, I suspect make
that trash art.
And my otter's going to look like a lamprey, I think. Like, straight up lamprey.
But that's okay, because lampreys need love too.
I love lampreys. It's my new favorite. It's my new favorite animal.
And they really are a keystone species for indigenous people here on the Oregon coast. So, yes.
Right. I had no idea. I had no idea. I've been doing a lot of research on them, and I find them fascinating. They may be one of the oldest vertebrates in the area. Like, they're... Yeah. Like 450, 500 million years old. I love them.
Yeah,
love
they're them. Cool.
Who else is doing this kind of stuff, this kind of creative work you're doing? You've mentioned Washed Away a little bit. Tell me a little bit.
Washed Ashore.
Washed Ashore, that's right.
There's actually a lot of artists internationally that work in this medium. There's quite a few others here in the United States. Really, to get acquainted with other marine debris artists, I recommend jumping on Instagram and just searching the hashtag marine debris artist or marine debris art. And you're going to find a lot of artists globally that are doing this work. You know, we're a growing community and we're pretty all well connected. We all kind of follow each other's work and support each other and what we do.
And I was going to say, how do you stay abreast of like advancements in the field and strategies and whatnot?
Yeah, through social media. I follow a lot of, you know, researchers, scientists, artists, nonprofit organizations that are either, you know, hosting beach cleanups or are on the policy side of things or on the innovation side of things. So, you know, there's always new things to learn.
Right.
And it's constantly evolving.
And do you find Oregon a pretty supportive community for artists? Like, do they appreciate your work? Do they support your work? Do they look for your work?
I feel very supported here in Oregon. I work with a lot of different nonprofits. This past year, I worked with the Alaco Alliance. I also worked with the Redfish Rocks community team out of Port Orford and created a wall mural piece depicting the Redfish Rocks Marine Reserve that's now hanging in the Port Orford Visitor Center. Fantastic. I also worked with Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition. We partnered with the Forest Service to go out and remove debris from the plover habitat restoration areas.
Right.
They're remote. They don't get a lot of love from community beach cleanups because they're hard to get to.
Right.
So we partnered with the Forest Service and got some volunteers out to these areas to do some intensive cleanups. And then as part of that grant funding that we got to do that project, we spent some time in Curry County Schools and did some art and ecology workshops. And that was a lot of fun. And we're going to do that again here in 2024.
What age group of children were you working with?
We worked from kindergarten, I think, all the way up to maybe eighth grade.
Oh, that'd be fantastic.
So
I can see that being really popular.
Yeah, it was really fun.
That's cool.
A lot of fun.
Do you have a studio? Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I do. I have a large studio. As I say, I'm getting ready to partner with an organization called Heart of Cardone up in Wheeler, Oregon, north of Lincoln City. They're a really neat organization. They're all about repurposing and reusing and recycling, and they're doing a marine debris kind of workshop retreat, you know, creative reuse of marine
right.
debris. So I'm really excited to go up and see their makerspace. They do a lot of repair and fix it workshops for people that want to repair things at home. Yeah, they seem like a really neat organization. So I'm really excited to go check out their space and be part of this weekend retreat coming up on the weekend of November 3rd, 4th, and 5th.
Third, fourth, and fifth. Is that closed?
Yeah.
Is it something?
Still open. There's still open registration for that.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah. And we're going to be doing, like, if you don't want to do the whole weekend retreat, you can participate. I think it's like $20 for the Friday night. There's going to be a lot of presentations
right. That
are going to be done from folks like myself and others. I think the Alaco Alliance is going to be there, which I just found out yesterday, which is really cool because I'm bringing the sea otter with me.
I'm coming for the sea otter myself.
And and then Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition is also going to be there. So I love that I've partnered with both these organizations and they're both going to be there presenting on their work. Some of it is work that was done with me. So, and I'm going to obviously be presenting on, you know, my stuff that I've done, you know, Alaska cleanups and expeditions and whatnot, and, you know,
That's fantastic.
I do my art. So, and then I'll be leading an art workshop on Saturday.
Okay. All righty, cool. And you said you do have a studio in Bandon, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have a big metal building on my property that I use. I wish it was insulated. It gets a little cold in the wintertime. I can't work out there all year round because between the cold and the condensation, it's not a pleasant place to be in the winter, even with a wood stove. But maybe I'm hoping someday to afford to insulate it
right.
So I can work year round doing what I do.
And can people come by there? Or is that just for your work?
It's just for my work. It's
okay.
At my home.
Yeah. Alrighty.
I don't really have a public space, but if people want to see my work, they can stop by the Port Orford Visitor Center or the Charleston Marine Life Center. I do have a piece there. Right now they're actually in Brookings. If anyone can get to Brookings to the Manly Art Center before November 1st, they can see a lot of my pieces there. Otherwise, Port Orford Visitor Center, Charleston Marine Life Center, and then also Seven Devils Brewing Company in Coos Bay owns some of my work as well.
Fantastic. Now, let me ask you one more following up question because my son asked me to. You had gotten started in Alaska with the Island Trails Network. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For the Alaska cleanups, can you just really quickly tell us what that is and if it's still going and if people
can
still jump
Island
in
Trails
on that?
Island Trails Network is still around. A lot of the work that they started doing originally was trail maintenance and also being able to, you know, to build trails that people could use to connect, you know, villages together, you know, because this is remote Alaska. And so they put down a lot of like geoblock so that the ground wouldn't get tore up and rutted
Right.
from four-wheelers, ATVs. They would build bridges so that ATVs were not going through salmon streams and things like that. So they were doing a lot of trail work and then also enhancing recreational trails for hikers and things like that. But they also started getting into marine debris removal. And so they started, I believe, in 2010 was when they were starting to look at doing marine debris removal. So by the time 2013 rolled around, they were getting into some large scale expeditions. And that's kind of when I got involved in it.
Cool. And it's still going on?
It's still going. Yeah.
So
they
folks
do an outdoor film festival every year too. It's like their one fundraiser a year that they do.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, you can
nice.
Look them up on the internet. They do a lot of good work.
That's Island Trails Network for Alaska.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll look
yeah,
that
they've
up.
Kind of, the guy that founded that, he's kind of branched out, and is on a new project called the Ocean Recovery Project. I think Ocean Plastics Recovery Project.
Okay.
And so he's now trying to innovate and find uses for this stuff rather than it going to the landfill. It's exciting.
This
so,
is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Check them out. Support them if you can. They're doing good work.
Absolutely. Elizabeth, this has been awesome. I am so inspired. I loved your work when I first saw it. And again, I'm not an artist, but I appreciate art. And I really, this is a wonderful way to use your life and with your passion and your talent. And I appreciate so much you joining us today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you reaching out and helping me spread the word.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And this has been an episode of Living Downstream. Thank you so much, Elizabeth.